As I mentioned last night, this year I want to reflect on moments in the Jewish life cycle. Today on birth, tomorrow on bar and bat mitzvah, on kol nidre, about marriage, on Yom Kippur morning about death. As I said last night, it's not to say that there's nothing between marriage and death. I just want to make sure you clarify that. And at Ne'ilah, a few thoughts on the afterlife. As I was getting dressed this morning, I just want to do a survey. How many of you in the room work in some way or another in something related to the medical sciences or just in medicine? Yeah, great. Okay. I was thinking about that this morning as I'm giving a, you know, prepare to talk on birth, right? Trying to figure out how qualified I am to do that, but we'll see. I want to begin with a question, which is, if, as the High Holiday Machzor tells us, that Rosh Hashanah commemorates the birthday of the world, we will hear in a few minutes, Hayom Harat Olam, today the world was created, then what would you think should be the Torah reading for today? Genesis, Bereishit. Something about the creation of the world. But it's not. It's not today, it's not tomorrow, it's not at any point during the high holiday season. Today we read about the birth of Isaac. And the Haftarah recalls the birth of Samuel. What both of these stories have in common is the pain of barren women and the miracle of birth. Why? The liturgy for Rosh Hashanah refers to today as the birthday of the world, but that is not actually the whole story. There is another strain in the Jewish tradition, an early Midrashic source, Pisca Rabati, that states that the world was created actually last Shabbat. 6 days ago, on the 25th of Elul, and that today Rosh Hashanah celebrates not the birthday of the world, but the creation of human beings. What we remember today is birth. I don't confess great medical insight, nor great personal insight into the experience, the physical experience of giving birth. I've never done it, except, like all of us, I was there when I was the one being birthed, and I don't remember much of that at all. I do know that the Jewish tradition doesn't seem to actually make much of birth. That may be why. That may be what happens when you have a 2,000-year-old tradition which was written almost entirely by men. As women's voices join the chorus of our tradition, God willing, that will change. But for now, I looked up birthdays in the new Encyclopedia Judaica. There's a new one. And here's what it said. The celebration of birthdays is unknown in traditional Jewish ritual. The only reference to a birthday in the Bible is that celebrated by Pharaoh. Not a good precedent. We celebrate birthdays on Shabbat morning here at Bethel, and there's nothing wrong with it, but historically, Jews didn't make a whole lot of birthdays. There's no blessing when a baby is born, except perhaps a general blessing. We say, Hatov HaMetiv, that God is the one who is good and the one who makes good. We say a Misha Berach, a prayer for healing for the mom and prayer for speedy recovery of the mom and the health of the baby. You can learn a lot about Jewish attitudes towards things, by the way, from our greetings, our one or two word responses to various moments. The difference between, say, Good Shabbos and Shabbat Shalom. Between Shana Tova, have a good year, and Tzom Kal, have an easy fast. When we hear that a woman is pregnant, the tradition is actually not to say Mazal Tov. The tradition is to say Bishah Tova, which means in a good hour, a sort of shorthand wish that the birth is uncomplicated and that everyone makes it through safely. Because birth is filled with anxiety. Kohelet, the book of Ecclesiastes, teaches Tov Shem Mishemen Tov Yom Hamavet Miyom Hivaldo. Better is the day of death than the day of one's birth. Rabbi Levi explains this in a parable. He says that two ships, the way to understand that is that think about two ships that set sail in the Mediterranean. One is leaving the harbor, and the other is returning home. And Rabbi Levi is in this place where everyone is rejoicing at the ship which is leaving the harbor, and this ship that has come home from a long journey slips into the port without any incident. And there's an intelligent man who is standing there at the port and watching these two ships, and he says, I see something topsy-turvy here. There's no point in rejoicing when a ship is leaving, because you don't know what is going to happen to that ship on the journey. You don't know what conditions are going to be the seas, what challenges they're going to face, what wind they're going to encounter. But when everyone should rejoice when a ship returns to port, because we know that it has successfully completed its voyage. The wise man is saying something profound, that life begins with anxiety as much as any joy we feel, because we don't know what seas a child is going to encounter, what wind she may face in her life. Today we are born again. Today we prepare to set sail for another year. Do we know what the seas hold in store for us? Do we believe that we can keep illness at bay? Are we certain that our marriages will last? That we'll have a job? That conflicts across the world will continue to stay so far away? Are we sure that Israel will survive? Rabbi Yaakov Liner, the Rebbe of Ishbitz and later Radzin, once taught that a person should not pray while drunk, because the whole world appears to you like a flat, wide plain with no mountains and no valleys, just easy going. And the rabbis knew that life isn't like that. They were filled with anxiety when a baby entered the world, not knowing what that world held in store. Infant mortality used to be much higher. A baby was not named until the bris. If it was a boy, a girl was not usually named immediately. Full mourning rites were not observed if a baby died in the first 30 days, not out of cruelty, but because such deaths were, if not commonplace, not unexpected. But the rabbi's anxiety about birth may not have been rooted merely in concerns about infant mortality, about whether a child would live, but rather about what kind of life that child would live. We may take human goodness for granted. The rabbis, they were not so sure. According to the Talmud, the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel spent 2.5 years debating and arguing the following question. Would it have been better for human beings to never have been created in the first place? They spent 2.5 years arguing that question. Beit Shammai said, it's better that human beings were created. Beit Hillel said, no. It would have been better if we had not. They took a vote. And you know who won? Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai almost never wins. But on this, the house of Shammai won. Perhaps, the rabbi said, the world would have been better off had human beings never been created. But now that we were, each of us must investigate our past deeds, or others say, examine our future actions. We must make ourselves worthy of the lives that we've been given. I had my own little debate this year with my son Benjamin. He knows about this, it's okay. on a hot and humid summer day, I needed some help weeding the flower beds in front of our home, so I asked our son Benjamin if he'd help, which is not quite true. I told Benjamin to come outside and help me. Well, he wasn't so pleased about this, perfectly understandable, and he knows me well, so as we were sitting there weeding, he said to me, "Abba, what makes something a weed? I mean, why shouldn't we just leave everything to grow? Isn't it better for the weeds to grow because that's the way God made the world?" It's a good question. Now, no offense, buddy, but what he was really saying is, "I don't want a weed." But fully owning my rabbiness in that moment, and at the same time pitying him for growing up with a rabbi as a father, I decided to answer him the way that every 12-year-old boy wants to be answered, which is by reflecting on the book of Genesis. "You see, my son," I said, "Adam was the first human being. He was taken from the Adama, from the ground. That's where he gets his name. And the very first thing that God did was actually place Adam, who was, by the way, not a male or a female, she was just a human being without gender, place him in the garden, and you have your cards. You have your cards. And what God," Roger, can I borrow? I forgot mine, right? "And what God said to Adam is that his task was le'ovda u'lishomra, to work it and to keep it." God put Adam in the Garden of Eden, the Garden of Paradise, where everything was to be perfect, and said, "I want you to work it." In other words, "I want you to weed." So I said, "Benjamin, get weeding." This quieted him for a little while, but it did get me to thinking about how his question reflects a very old debate. Is it better just to let the weeds grow? Or should we try to make an impact on God's world? Is it better for human beings that we were created or not? I am trying, like many of you, to minimize my carbon footprint. I'm trying to raise my kids with the sense that they need to be stewards of the earth. But I wonder to what extent we and our children carry with us a sense of original environmental sin. By which I mean that our very existence on the earth is being understood now as a blemish, rather than a blessing. That it'd be better to have just a patch of weeds than a manicured garden. That the world would somehow be better off without us. I struggled with that once. In the midst of my deepest grief for my friend Joel, I went running for a few blocks on the streets of Phoenix, where I was for a business trip, and I stopped. I was out of shape. And I thought about my childhood that I spent working out and how strong I was and in shape then. And I became profoundly aware of the pull of the gravity of our body's slow decay towards death. I thought of my children so young and what awaited them, and a wave of anguish rushed over me. And I asked myself, what have I done to bring them into a world that is filled with so much pain? And I asked, could it be that the world would be better off without me, without us, and what I had done to bring them into it? It's been a rough summer, filled with pain and bloodshed in Israel. It is easy to feel despair, to think sometimes that after so many wars and so much pain, that Israel is a blemish and not a blessing, that perhaps we should have just left the swamp alone, not tried to make the desert bloom, not struggled to carve out a place of our own. War and bloodshed, grief and death can make us wonder if it's possible for us to do any good in the world after all. That is not what the Jewish tradition teaches. It is not what we believe. We don't celebrate birth and birthdays because those are natural, biological moments. What we celebrate in the beginning of life is the entrance of the child into the covenant. We celebrate not merely natural life, the world of nature, but the life of the spirit, the special role that human beings can play. A famous midrash tells of a conversation between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus, a Roman governor. Rufus scoffed at the idea, at the mitzvah of circumcision, asking Rabbi Akiva, whose handiwork is more impressive, that of God or that of human beings? And this challenge to the Brit Milah, to circumcision, essentially reduces into, if God wanted circumcised males, God would have created them circumcised. Rabbi Akiva replied as follows. He showed Rufus raw stalks of wheat alongside freshly baked loaves of bread. And he said, which one is better? The first, he pointed out, is the work of God. And the second one is the work of human beings. And the bread is better. And that shows us that, in fact, the work of human beings surpasses the work of the Almighty. The debate recorded here is a serious and fundamental one. It is about whether nature is the most perfect creation. Are human beings incapable of attaining anything greater than what occurs naturally in the world? And is each weed that we pull, each imposition of our will upon the natural world, is that ultimately a sin for which we must repent? Rabbi Akiva argues that nature is not perfect. Nature contains sweetness and poison, and the human task is to elevate and perfect nature, to create bread from wheat, to circumcise a baby boy, and by doing so, inculcate in his heart the idea that this child is a partner of God in creating the world and bringing it to its ultimate perfection. For Rufus, creation belongs exclusively to God. That's something only God can do. God is some sort of manufacturer of the world. We are the consumers, and by making a sacrifice every once in a while, or by saying a blessing, or by being grateful, we're allowed to enjoy a world manufactured by the divine. And it places human beings in the position of being receivers, not creators of the world. The Jewish conception is radically different. God did not merely give us a finished product that we can enjoy by asking nicely. The world that we have is imperfect. It is in need of repair. And human beings are charged with the responsibility and the hopeful belief that we can repair. In the context of the human covenant, of the covenant between God and the Jewish people, human action is not doomed to sin. It contains within it the potential and even the imperative for ultimate redemption. Jewish tradition records no debate about the creation of the rest of the world. Only the creation of the human being was actually open to debate, not only by Hillel and Shammai, but in other places as well, because the human being alone has free will. And because we do, only our actions can be either good or evil. Mark Twain once said, "Man is the only animal that blushes or needs to." Our lives are never neutral. Through our actions, we write ourselves into the book of life and death, not physical life and death, But the life and death that matters, the life and death of the Spirit, we can be judged because we have free will, because we were created not merely to be part of the ecosystem, but to use our free will for moral and spiritual achievements. Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik wrote, "Man must strive to become subject and not object. One who influences one's surroundings rather than one who is merely influenced. One who creates and is not created. One who acts and is not merely acted upon. One who controls his environment rather than merely being controlled by it." Sin, he says, occurs when man becomes an object. When God confronts Adam after eating from the tree of knowledge, what does he say? "The woman made me do it." When God confronts Eve, what does Eve say? "See, the snake tricked me." Soloveitchik concludes that both of these characters emphasized their helplessness in overcoming an external influence that forced their fail and forced their fall. A baby, when it's born, is helpless against his or her will. The covenant begins the process of initiating a child into the world of free will and responsibility rather than just the natural world. And that's why we celebrate it. One final thought about these reflections of our community. I hope that it's evident that the insights that I hope to share during the high holidays about these life cycle moments don't merely apply to people who've personally experienced them. The question of birth is not merely a question of biology. I have counseled couples in our community this year who are struggling to conceive. Others in our community are single and will never have biological children. Still, others may have children, but no grandchildren. I know we have a lot of doctors in our community, and I'm grateful for what you do. Biology is important, but it is not the whole of human life. Not everyone can bring a child into the natural world, but everyone can help to bring a child into the covenant. The Talmud teaches, "Kol hamigadel yitom betoch beto ma'aleh alav hakatuv ki'ilu yilado." Whoever raises an orphan in his home is considered by Scripture as though he or she birthed them into the world. The Midrash teaches, "Hamigadel nikra av velo hamolid." The one who raises a child is called the parent and not the one who births it. "It takes a village" is a very Jewish idea. A child has many parents because in a Jewish community, the life that matters the most is not the genes that we inherit, but the lessons that we learn that transform the world. We're all children in need of parents, of people who can help us to take responsibility for our lives, to make a mark upon the world for good. We are all parents who can help another to grow. I want to leave you with an image from one of my teachers, Rabbi Levi Meir, Zichrono Levracha, who was a chaplain at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. He once taught that the task of life is for us to be midwives to one another. A midwife, he said, helps a mother to breathe, to alleviate her suffering by being fully present, and in the end, helps to give her the strength of bringing another individual life into the world. Can we do that for each other this year? Can we help one another to breathe when life takes our breath away? Can we be present, and in doing so, help to alleviate one another's suffering? Can we help each other to change, and by doing so, bring another life into the world this year? Ken Yehi Ratzon, may it be, and let us say, Amen.